It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a Milwaukee meditation teacher's six-year journey of finding their way back to what matters most after losing meaning in everyday things. You can call in with a question. You can share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ben Cott is owner of Mind MKE. New book is called The Way Home, Discovering the Hero's Journey to Wholeness at Midlife. Ben, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much, Kate. It's good to be here.
Well, let's talk about this time in your early 30s. You realize you lost your heart. What does that mean to you?
Well, I would say the initial discovery, there was sort of an epiphany moment. And the first realization was a sense of burnout, exhaustion, fatigue in life in general. But as I started to pull back the layers, I discovered that really it was this sense that I couldn't move through the world in the same way that I had previously, which was, you know, an obsession for achievement, chasing after perfection and the approval of others.
You said you were like producing on this hamster wheel and perfecting and performing. Why was that so tantalizing to you?
Well, I think there were multiple layers to that. One would be that as a culture, we really value those things. We love to celebrate those who are hustling and achieving. But as I started to look more deeply, there was also, you know, there's family and religious narratives that fed into that approach to life. And then just some personal things that really were mine. I mean, really, it was all mine to deal with, but some sort of things that I needed to confront in myself, ultimately.
How can someone figure out if they have, you know, in your words, lost their heart? What is that, you know, coming to that recognition?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think really the key is to arrange your life in such a way that you can listen to your own life. We go at an insane pace so often, and we fill our lives with all sorts of activities and we start to quiet out that inner voice. And so it's really important to find practices like meditation or journaling or walking in nature that will help you tune in to what's going on inside of you. And also, honestly, what happens if you don't make space for that, you're going to be interrupted in some way. Like your heart is going to speak up and say, hey, it's time to pay attention to me.
It makes me think about you know, you were talking to your spouse about your aspirations and she told you to get quiet. How did that phrase change your life?
Oh, yeah, that was a good one. So we were walking on the campus, University of Washington, where we used to live in Seattle, and like the cherry blossoms were out and we had just come out of, they have this amazing Hogwarts style library there. And yeah, I was getting all excited about this, the next level of a project that I was working on. And, you know, in the middle of this lovely afternoon together, I'm kind of scheming about what I will do and ask for her advice. And, you know, I was hoping she would just affirm my ambitious ways. And she just paused. And as so many times in our marriage, this has been the case, she just had this incredible wisdom. And it was those two words, get quiet. And it was really one of those moments where these words were symbolic for a message that had been chasing me down for a long time. It was yet again another reminder to go inward, to slow down, to really try to be internally referenced as opposed to externally referenced, which is, you know, constantly trying to be reactive to the inputs and the noise and the commotion around me.
Ben Cott with us, author of The Way Home, as we talk about his new book on finding yourself in midlife. You can join in along the way. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Ben, your journey, you know, involves you taking a four-month sabbatical. It involves leaving your old job. Are financial obligations a significant barrier to doing this type of self-work?
That is an incredible question. I mean, one thing, while my journey did include the gift of a sabbatical, so I was used to be an ordained minister, and one of the perks in that world, as it's kind of increasingly in other spaces, maybe in different spots in corporate America, maybe tech and whatnot, academia for sure, but sabbatical is one of them. So my family took that opportunity to travel around the country and see people, and it was an incredible gift. So having had that experience was amazing, but I'm also, it's really important for me to say, like, look, you don't need to like eat, pray, love your way around the world. You don't need to go on some exotic journey, like externally or in the world. You actually can go on the inner journey from the comfort of your own home. I mean, there's, whether it's wandering through your neighborhood park or, meeting up with a trusted friend at a local cafe or deep dive in journaling or therapy or things like that. There's all sorts of ways that we can go on this journey that don't necessarily require, having a ton of money in the bank account. But I will say that going on the journey can challenge some of our, our sense of security and stability as far as finances are concerned. And there may be ways that we're clinging to those things a little bit too much, as we often do in this culture, that we need to kind of challenge that so we can open up space for new versions of ourselves to emerge.
But letting go, that ability to let go doesn't have to be like quitting your job without another one waiting or moving across the country. It can be in the little things as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's very important for me in the book, especially to mention that. I mean, my own letting go, it's like I had to let go of something before ultimately it led to, say, a job change. So I was in a job that I was not satisfied in. I didn't feel, but that actually was part of what challenged me is like I had tied up my identity and like the work I do is sort of novel and impactful and significant and I'm achieving things. And suddenly I was in a job where I didn't feel like any of that was happening. And so the easy thing to do would have been to quote unquote let go of that job and leave it. But it was actually in the staying in the job that was difficult, that it challenged some of my patterns that were hindering me in terms of my own growth. So I had to let go of kind of that deeper tie and allegiance to those things we mentioned earlier, the achievement, perfection, and up getting the approval of others. I had to let go of that. Eventually, things on the surface of my life changed, like the job changed. But I think sometimes we want to start with the surface level thing. Like you said, we want to move or we want the job change, but really that might just mask the inner work that we need to do.
You were a pastor before your journey of self-discovery, and by the end of this time, you leave the church and you ultimately pursue a new career path. What was that like to leave the church and that, that not only is your livelihood, but it is really the center of who you are, your soul?
Yeah, so I am so grateful for all the years I had as like a pastor. I started a church in Seattle, and some of my closest friends to this day were a part of that endeavor. And so it's sort of an interesting thing because while I did let go of maybe the external aspects of that religious identity, in terms of my ordination status or the role and the profession. When I look back at the story, and I think this also comes through in the book, it's like I see this incredible continuity that throughout my calling or my sense of purpose, I've always felt like spirituality and community or belonging and social healing, social change it's kind of my work and my calling has been at the intersection of those things. So while externally, that's changed now, and I do coaching and I teach meditation as well as a few other things. There feels like there is this continuity between it. But yeah, it is, it's really hard to leave something, especially when it's like it's your career and there is such a sense of belonging. And in the religious space, when you leave something, that can be hard for other people because it brings up all sorts of questions for them. So, yeah, I think a lot of that is still probably working itself out in my life. But when I look back at all of it, I just am filled with gratitude for that part of my story.
Ben Cott, his book is called The Way Home, as we discuss personal development. You can call in with a question. You can share your insights along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A spiritual coach in Milwaukee uses a combination of solitude and wandering in the wild, meditation, and more techniques to find inner peace. Ben Cott's new book documenting this 6-year journey, it's called The Way Home, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Ben, throughout the book, you cite author Joseph Campbell, who first dubbed the term hero's journey. Can you explain who was Joseph Campbell and how did he inform your enlightenment in midlife?
Yeah, so Joseph Campbell was a mid-20th century mythologist. So he studied myth and religion from across, you know, culture and time and place. And as he did that, interacting with the work of others, he discovered this common pattern or this storyline, this monomyth, as he often talked about it, that he said runs through all of these ancient stories. That's what he called the hero's journey. And it really has, he had like 17 steps, so I won't go through all of those, but he had three main stages. And he talked about departure, initiation, and return. And so when I was emerging from this journey in my own life and started to reflect back, and it was really the early stages of this book, I had been interacting and studying Campbell's work, and it was like a light bulb went off. I was like, this is what I went through. This is exactly what I experienced. And so knowing that his work is, some of it's kind of inaccessible, like it's, you know, these big old tomes that most people aren't going to read, and yet people are familiar with his ideas because it ended up impacting like Hollywood movies. George Lucas, for example, Star Wars, really borrowed this pattern as he wrote like the Luke Skywalker story. Many others have as well. But I started to say, what would it look like to use this as a lens to tell my story so that I could help everyday people who are going on this inner journey? And so in my book, there's three stages. I talk about them as leaving the familiar, falling into the unknown, and rising to wholeness.
And it's so interesting because you're very transparent about going through these different aspects. I'm just wondering, when you went through this journey, at what point did you think about, you know, turning it into a book or really being transparent with a lot more people than maybe just your family and tight circle?
Yeah, you know, I'm laughing right now because I'm wondering, you know, the book comes out today. I'm like, am I going to have a vulnerability hangover tomorrow? Like, I'm very excited that people are going to be reading it. Like, I'm really excited. And also, I'm like, what have I done? You know, so yeah. I will say that, like, when I started writing, it was a part of just reflecting on my own journey. And then I was like, okay, I think I'm writing a story. And maybe I'll share it with my kids, my wife, people close to me. But after a few months, it started snowballing. And I was like, this is like a thing. This is a book. And I spent about a year and a half on my own writing it. I'd get up early in the morning. And, you know, amazing to have a supportive partner who'd like, you know, take point on getting the kids out the door. But I'd write before work. And, you know, I really was like, I need to finish this. So I wrote the whole book, a manuscript, without having anyone look at it, which is, they tell you not to do that. And without even thinking, oh, I need to go get this published. I just knew I needed to pay attention to the craft. And, you know, since you've read it, to like part of it, I was working out my own story is, can I make this thing and enjoy it and delight in it without the sense of I need to have it become something huge, right? Mm-hmm. So just being in that. So I would say there's been multiple stages of like, now, okay, people close to me have read it or getting endorsements. And, you know, I'm just aware that like if my story, which in many ways I feel like is very ordinary, if I can share that and it can impact someone, I think the vulnerability or the openness, it's all worth it.
I appreciated that you would turn to someone named Tal Tim and keep coming back to someone who would be able to be a really deep listener for you and also kind of like this pillar as you went through this process. Can you talk about, you know, who people can turn to in going through this discovery?
Yeah. So the second chapter is called Get Help. And I think it's really important to remember that any inner journey, while ultimately it's something like only you can do, no one else can do it for you. You can't live vicariously through any podcaster or preacher or guru or influencer or whoever, author. Like, you have to do it. And yet, guess what? You're not isolated. You're not alone. Not only have people been on this before or people are going through it now, but there are people who will come alongside you and support you. And they're an essential part of this journey. So help is important. And I talk about this Celtic idea. This is Celtic Christian. So coming out of like Ireland, back in the day, this idea of the Anamkara, which means soul friend. A soul friend is really someone, I think this is a beautiful term, but it's someone who is like a mirror. They're a safe space for you, and they're a mirror who can reflect back to you the truest parts of who you are. Now, there's going to be a way in which at times when you need to be comforted, they'll do that. But there's other times where, guess what? Like, your narratives and patterns need to be disrupted. And so they also bring that. Like, they are someone who's fiercely there for you, so that you can become your fullest, truest self. And so Anamkaras, these soul friends, come in all kinds of forms, and they can be your partner, or they can be a dear friend, could be a therapist, or could be like a spiritual community or AA group. For me, it was a spiritual director or a spiritual companion, which not everyone's familiar with that, but essentially these are people who are, you could say they're professional Anamkaras. They hold space for you to kind of reflect on your life in terms of the different things you're experiencing and the version of you that's emerging.
Ben Cott is with us, author of The Way Home, as we talk about finding yourself in midlife. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Ben, you have this mantra, grace, space, and pace. Can you explain, what do those words mean in this journey?
Yeah, you know, I got to make sure that I make a disclaimer so I don't get sued. But those are not my words. what's amazing is they came to me, and it's a story that's in the book, and it's kind of this twisted tale. But like one morning, as I was like in the early stages of this burnout, and I was like, I need to do something different. Like, I can't keep going at this pace. I can't keep operating in this way. And it was a, believe it or not, like a 1950s, 1960s. We're talking like Mad Men era Jaguar ad that was in a magazine. I came across it on the internet, and it's grace, space, pace, which of course means for them like elegant and spacious, roomy and fast for this car. But as soon as I saw those words, I was like, these are for me. And so, yeah, it has become, in that sense, a mantra, something that can keep calling me back to, really at its core, a different way of moving through the world, which prioritizes you know, my inner life and this sense of being connected to my true self. So, you know, for grace for me was just learning to receive from others, and whether that's hospitality or the kindness of others. Space was just like not, you know, being so jam-packed with my schedule, like making space to take solitude or intentional aloneness for myself. And then pace, obviously, unlike the car, which is speed up and beat fast, this was about slowing down. And so I had to, you know, found ways to slow down in my life. And I think all three of those were really the foundation for my journey, and they're practices I carry with me to this day. And also, I think they're essential for anyone who wants to get their heart back.
Perhaps in the space category, maybe, I really appreciated how you would find these spaces in your life and in the world, in nature, and know that they were like a little sacred place that you would go to think and to be alone. I think they were like spot of time, or
yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
So William Wordsworth, the poet, he had this term called a place, a spot of time. It's a spot of time if it's a place that has like a renovating virtue. It's like a place that renews you. Like, and you know, even as you're listening to this, like maybe not if you're driving, but you could close your eyes and you could visualize a place that, you know, it's like that is rejuvenating place. And it could be in the middle of, like, say, you know, we're in Wisconsin, could be up north somewhere in the middle of the woods, or it could be a cabin on the lake, or it could be this particular bend in the trail at your neighborhood park. Maybe even a specific tree that just has like captivated you every time you walk by it. These are places that, whether we're in seasons of like that are incredible, filled with like joy and goodness, or we're in, you know, dealing with grief and despair and loneliness, when we come back to these places, really nature through us connecting, like it shows us something about who we are. Or there's a comforting aspect of it. It can anchor us in a world that's always changing, and maybe in those moments where everything's falling apart, we can come back to what is, because at the end of the day, like, whatever that spot in nature is, it just is. It's being what it needs to be. A stream is streaming, or the tree's being the tree, and it helps us come back into our essential self as well.
Have you found a spot of time in Milwaukee?
Absolutely. So, but if I tell everyone, they're gonna join me there. I mean, so
Because
I'll just
I
say
was
this.
mourning for your spot of time being halfway across the country.
Yeah, so I am going to Seattle this week, and I will absolutely visit that space. What's amazing about moving here is, my wife's family's from Ontario, Canada, so we're both kind of Great Lakes people. I'm from the area here initially, Greater Milwaukee area, so we're very excited about the lake. Without giving away too many details, I'll just say what surprised me and what I have fallen in love with is the Milwaukee River. There's these incredible trails that are pretty quiet. There's a bunch of people fishing on them right now. But
Well,
like, I love going down there.
let's pause there with Ben Cott, Milwaukee native. The book is The Way Home. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore a meditation teacher's journey in slowing down and learning to listen to their inner compass. Ben Cott's six-year journey of personal development is now a guidebook. It's called The Way Home. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ben, you cite a concept from Yale Divinity School professor Willie James Jennings' book, After Whiteness, and you say people are suffering under three values that Jennings identifies in his book, possession, control, and mastery. What are the issues with these values?
Yeah, he sort of ironically calls them, he takes it even a step further, he calls them virtues, to express this way that sort of a lot of Western culture, you could say, has this allegiance to mastery, control, and possession. And I would say that I came across those words when I had been running a podcast, and I had been in conversations with all sorts of people who were doing really important work in terms of working for justice and equality. And I realized that while, yes, I was working through some dynamics in my own life that got me oriented towards achievement and perfection and approval, that actually this was like this deeper cultural layer that was informing how I went about the world. And it's really, it's a hostile way of engaging things because we're trying to control or possess or take control of, rather than really more like engage in a dance with life and be receptive and be vulnerable and be curious.
You mentioned as well that you think especially men are taught at a young age to be that strong and tough and self-sufficient. Does that impede on finding yourself? What about men at midlife?
Yeah, one of the sort of playful things about the title of this book, which has Hero's Journey in the title, and that's obviously, as we talked about earlier, Joseph Campbell's work. There is a sense that I think if you're to talk about being a hero, it often conjures up in people's imagination this idea of the heroic individual, someone who's kind of on their own and accomplishing incredible things and swooping in to save the day. And so, interestingly, I sort of hope this appeals to people who maybe are drawn to that. And is in a way, I'll say it here, which means maybe it won't be this anymore, but it's a subversive invitation. So we're drawn to this idea of being heroic and kind of being like the master of our life and what's happening. But there is actually inside of that, in this story, in this path, there's like this invitation into gentleness and vulnerability. And so, yeah, like I think men especially, we build up all sorts of layers, and it's because of cultural narratives and family stuff and, our own issues that we start to move through the world in a very particular way that shuts out the kind of help we need and that openness to just be more vulnerable and tender and be people who are in touch with our grief and our pain.
You have to be quite vulnerable going through some darkness in this journey. And I'm wondering if you can kind of explain the Death Lodge experience as you go through this kind of place of grief and then as well as gratitude.
Yeah, so the Death Lodge is a concept I first came across in the work of eco-psychologist Bill Plotkin, who's got this book called Soulcraft, which was a big companion for my journey. But one day I had a friend who facilitates these kinds of experiences, met up at local park. This is actually right where my spot of time is, that sacred place we were talking about earlier. But a death lodge is, it can be a real or imaginary place. But the idea is, you essentially, when you're marking a season of severance from something, and that can be a relationship or a role, a job, anything on the surface of your life, but more often kind of that deeper pattern of operating, whether it's, perfectionist or controller or victim or escapist or whatever the thing might be that you realize is no longer serving you. A death lodge is a way of interacting with it and basically saying to this part of yourself, hey, thank you for what you've done, because actually that part worked to keep you safe or help you move through the world. But to be grateful for what that way of being entailed, and also grieve the fact that you're no longer going to have that as your center of gravity. And so often the things you're thankful for and you're grieving the loss of, those will be the same. But also with the grief, there will be other things, other aspects of that identity that have caused you pain that it's time to relinquish and say goodbye to.
Are there any types of ritual practices as you go through that processing that you would recommend or that helped you? I know you looked to poetry as well in that time.
Yeah, so poetry, I think it's Audre Lorde, says it gives name to the nameless, so it can be thought. So poetry can be a powerful companion, because look, like I started writing some poetry just for myself. I share a little in the book. It's not too incredible. The point isn't to be like this incredible poet, but like both reading poetry and experimenting with your own is a way to surface some of those deeper things. So in addition to poetry, obviously journaling, as I mentioned, having this a particular place you go to, as we've talked about earlier, that's really important. All these things, they help us like see that even though we're on this inner journey, which sometimes like it can feel really murky and unclear, we start to notice like, oh, I've made progress. I am growing. Look how I'm showing up differently in my relationships, or the new energy I'm bringing to my work. Like, we start to see that because we're doing this inner work, we're kind of tracking and mapping, like, okay, stuff's happening in the underworld that's starting to express itself, like, in our day-to-day lives.
We're talking about a new book on finding yourself in midlife. Ben Cott is with us, author of The Way Home. You can call in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ben, you name your imposter with a capital I, imposter. And I'm just wondering about these, as you said, obsessions with producing and perfecting, but then you kind of shed your achievement imposter and you discover that there is also another layer, a mask. Can you talk about what was underneath that?
Yeah, so I would say underneath, kind of behind these, the three-headed monster, the achiever, perfectionist, performer, there was what I call the reverent, obedient cadet, which is a callback to this, like, kind of like a Boy Scouts group affiliated with my church that I was in when I was growing up. And let me tell you, I wasn't very good at any of the Boy Scout type stuff. But this thing, like, I remembered this phrase, and there's a whole bunch of other kind of beautiful words, like being compassionate and thoughtful, like all these things that come with it. But that became this reverent, obedient cadet, kind of became this really this tender identity that was behind all these things that was making me op, you know, kind of contributing to how I was operating. And what I mean specifically is there's a sense of like loyalty and allegiance, which are wonderful things. They're very important qualities. And there's ways that when we kind of start to lose ourselves and we become conformists who just kind of go along with the status quo and the way things are, and we start to shut off other parts of ourselves because we're trying to, stay safe, fit in. And so we play small and we kind of shave off the wild edges that exist within all of us.
So I'm wondering, why did you leave Seattle? I mean, that was a hard time for you. Why did you move to Milwaukee, back to your home base, in a sense?
Yeah, so in 2019, my wife and I had been thinking, like all our kids, they were all born in Seattle. Seattle's their home, and we had this amazing community there. But we were thinking in 2019, we came in April to visit, And it was snowing, and we're like, we're not moving. Okay, not going to happen. But a year later, guess what? What was happening a year later in early 2020? Well, we weren't the only ones who were suddenly asking deeper questions about, you know, about how we're spending our days on this earth. And so we were really feeling that pull to be back closer to family, to be somewhere where there's maybe a bit of a different pace, especially as our kids are getting older. So moved back to Milwaukee in large part because I have a brother here, my parents are here. We're within a drive from my wife's family. It's a long drive, but it's doable. And yeah, really, I would say it was like for years earlier before that, I kind of been thinking, I got to get out of here. But when we finally moved, it didn't come out of a place of anxiety or forcing anything. It just felt really natural.
How did you find a new community in Milwaukee? Because you had found such a close-knit group around you of friends and colleagues who almost became like family to you. And I feel like I can relate because our family spent, you know, years and years in Louisiana and also developed those really tight bonds, not with family, but with friends.
Yeah, you know, so a couple of things come to mind. First is we were fortunate to have, like, you know, my brother and sister-in-law, like, arms wide open when we got here. And then some other like people that I had known kind of growing up. But it was a challenging time to move because it was like, you know, 2020, the height of the pandemic. And so really, I would say it took a year or two before we started forging some new connections here. And some of it was, guess what I did during that time? I wrote this book. So the hibernating, it was a really lovely season. But, you know, there's sort of a different way, I would say, at least I'm approaching things here. I took a lot of responsibility. Like, my work was building community. And while I love that, there was a certain cost to that. And I feel like here, I'm just more open and responsive to those meaningful relationships as they've come. And, you know, guess what? It's happening.
Ben Cott is a meditation teacher, spiritual coach, and writer in Milwaukee. New guidebook for self-discovery. Call in with a question. You can share your comments along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a journey of self-discovery to gather wisdom and ability to face new trials, especially in a midlife transition. Ben Cott's new book is called The Way Home, and you can join the conversation. Call in with a question. Bring your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Julia in Madison is here. Julia, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
I've been listening with intrigue. I identify with a fair amount of things, but I also wondered if the author in his life experience has spent time in other cultures, and wondering if there's differences in terms of what he's talking about. Like, for example, I am middle class white. The book Caste and the movie Origins explores things across cultures. And I was wondering his thoughts on African Americans and their journey, people of poverty in different countries, how their experience might be.
Julia, thank you. Ben.
Yeah, thanks, Julia. Appreciate your question. You know, what I would say is the reason that these stories show up across time and place, and there's different accents and different shapes that they take, is because people for the longest time have been trying to make sense of this question of what does it mean to be human, and, you know, how do we live a life of meaning and purpose. And that's a question that people can ask regardless of their socioeconomic state. In fact, that's a question that people have always been asking. And so, you know, it's very important for me as I tell this story is that I think what can happen is this hero's journey, for example, it can get tied up in a lot of self-help spaces as something that is tied to a certain, you know, that like finding yourself also means you're suddenly going to be wealthy and everything's going to go well for you. And that's not what I'm saying in the book. What I am getting after is this idea that no matter what you go through no matter what adversity you face, which is different for people from different populations, for sure. There is this strong inner self that no one can ever take away. And we see this in the stories of some of the people who, people across time who've suffered in incredible ways. And at the end of the day, it's up to each of us to stay in tune with that, because no one else is really going to be advocating for that. In fact, that's where so much exploitation and oppression is happening. It's trying to separate people from their core essential self. But the most resilient people we've seen across time and place, they're always the ones who are staying connected to what is true, not only about themselves, but about what it means to be human and to belong to one another.
After your wilderness time, you felt like you had to deepen your meditation practice. And I just am curious, how has meditation changed you?
It's been an absolute game changer. I mentioned a bunch of ritual practices in the book, from journaling and time in nature to dream work and this death lodge and also fasting and other things. But I would say that the most foundational practice is meditation, which I teach in Milwaukee and beyond. I have a twice a day for 20-minute meditation practice. I kind of think of it lately as like I'm microdosing solitude, and it's just getting that real a time each day to be recharged for the activity of the day. So sometimes people think meditation, it can be selfish, it can be an escape, but the reality is that like taking that 1 to 2% of your day, it can transform the rest of it. And it isn't about like becoming someone who's an incredible meditator with your eyes closed. It's really about how do you live fully and be more present and be someone who's, compassionate and seeking justice when your eyes are open.
Picking up on the fasting piece of this, you fasted for more than 4 days during the wilderness quest. What insight did fasting give you?
Yeah, what's funny is I just looked at the books on Spotify, and like one of the headings is like health advisory. So I'll just repeat that here. Like there's a, none of this is like if you're gonna consider fasting, you should do your research and know what you're getting into. But for me, it was tied with a wilderness experience. And I've done other, had other experiences with fasting. We see this across religious traditions, whether it's the Lent, for example, the Christian season of Lent that many are in right now, there's things that people are fasting from. Maybe it's eating certain things. Obviously, in Ramadan, it's this, the worldwide population of Muslims are fasting in incredible ways from sunrise to sundown. So we see this across, time because there's a transformative power. And so just to hit on a couple of what those things are, one, it can help us like actually access our grief. There's a sense that fasting happens when people are mourning. But another thing it does, it can in some ways alter our consciousness, or we could say that more gently, which is like open us up to the deeper conversation. And then also it just helps us see that like we're not tied to that like insatiable hunger or craving that we have, that there's something, it encourages us to go inward.
And then you were also trying to make sure you understood your dreams as well during that period of fasting. What were your dreams like?
Well, the one when I was fasting involved a former president and kind of a song and dance routine. So you'll have to read it to get that full story. But that really, I guess I would say there's certain dreams that can feel like they give you clarity for like the next step, like a step you need to take, something you need to shed, something you've outgrown. And really a basic tip for this is like keep a journal by your bedside, and when you first wake up, before checking your phone or whatever, just like you notice, like, is there like a lingering, like a remnant of a dream? And just scribble that down. The more you pay attention to that, the more you'll start to remember your dreams, and the more you'll be able to access meaning in your dreams. But then there's other dreams that maybe aren't just for you. There's almost like a visionary quality to them that I think at the end of the day, it's calling you to love more fully. If I can just kind of put that heading over it.
So, on this journey of self-work, you end up in Arizona where you hug and you cried for a cactus, a saguaro cactus. What did this experience teach you?
Yeah, what a strange story, right? What's fascinating is I had this experience. I came across this later there was like a speech that whatever his name is, the actor who's Iron Man, who I actually
Aren't
mention, who is that again? Tony Stark in Robert Downey Jr.
right,
Okay, he's
okay.
giving a speech and he's talking about recovery, and he mentions Mel Gibson, whose name we really can't say, I guess, but Mel Gibson told him one day like that he just needed to hug the cactus. This is like a thing, and I never heard this before. I'd had my experience in the desert. I heard this later, but really hugging the cactus was like just engaging your pain and your brokenness and your woundedness, and like just coming to terms with it. And I would say, when I look back at, this experience I had out in the desert, where I really felt like I was in a conversation with this saguaro cactus, it was all sorts of things, but one was it was a massive expression of grief, not only my own grief for the ways I've failed others and hurt others, but also in a sense like this grief over the human condition, in which we're estranged from one another, and which we take things out on each other and on the planet. And just think of all the horrible things going on right now and in any moment. And something about this encounter in the wild with this cactus was a way of processing this cosmic grief that we all carry.
You found bullets all around the cactus. How did that make you feel?
Oh yeah, I mean, this was the thing. The cactus was like, felt like it was saying, "I have a story to tell you." Okay, which is kind of a weird thing. But when I started just slowing down, I noticed it had been like stabbed by this wooden stake. And then, yeah, I kind of, it was like part crime scene investigation, part like mystical conversation. And I found four different caliber bullets around this thing, and I noticed it was riddled with bullets. And, the specific feeling I had was this heaviness. It's like, how many people had wandered up? There's this thing called cactus plugging. You kind of just go shoot a cactus. But I wanted to, it was almost like I felt something beneath that. It was like this anger and this hatred and this like isolation that somehow was being taken out on this cactus.
In our moments left, from where we left the book, I understand those bullets are still near your writing desk.
They're right over my shoulder right
They're right
now.
over your shoulder. Do you, why did you take them? Why are they with you as you write and are,
Yeah.
in your life?
Yeah, so in my space here, this little corner office in the basement, which also is known as the laundry room, just it depends on what angle you're looking at it. This is where I wrote the book, and I have all sorts of things, little like cards, like a mug with a cactus that says "Can't touch this." This is from my kids, and I have a pine cone that's a memory of a story that I experienced during the season. And I have a carving of a jaguar, and I keep all these things to remind me of the journey that I've been on, not to like call me and keep me in the past, but to keep sending me into the future as someone who's trying to become more fully alive and make the most generative contribution to the world in which we live.
Ben, thank you for joining us.
Now, Kate, this was amazing. Thank you for spending time with my stories and for your curiosity.
Ben Cott is author of The Way Home, Discovering the Hero's Journey to Wholeness at Midlife. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.